Welcome to SCOTUscast, Consumer Credit Repair and Arbitration Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 10, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in CompuCredit Corporation versus Greenwood. This case involves the Credit Repair Organizations Act, or CROA, which requires credit repair organizations to provide consumers with a disclosure informing them that they have a right to sue credit repair organizations that violate the act. At issue is whether a credit repair company that is being sued by former customers under CROA can force those customers to arbitrate their claims based on arbitration provision contained in the customer's credit card applications. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held by a vote of 8-1 that CROA does not address the arbitrability of claims made thereunder, and the Federal Arbitration Act therefore requires the arbitration agreement in this case to be enforced according to its terms. Justice Sotomayor filed a concurring opinion, joined by Justice Kagan. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Christopher Drahozel, who is a professor at the University of Kansas School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Drahozel.
On January 12, 2012, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in CompuCredit Corp. versus Greenwood, in which it held that the Credit Repair Organizations Act did not preclude arbitration of claims arising under the Act. In other words, that claims under the Act are arbitrable, can be decided in arbitration. Greenwood's the most recent of a trilogy of cases that were all written by Justice Scalia, that all reversed a decision of the Ninth Circuit, and that all upheld the enforceability of an arbitration clause. The two prior cases, which were Rent-A-Center West versus Jackson and AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, were much more difficult cases, frankly. They were 5-4 decisions with very strong dissents by, obviously, the four dissenting justices. Greenwood was an 8-1 decision, essentially. There was a concurring opinion that agreed with the majority's outcome. And, frankly, Greenwood follows pretty straightforwardly from prior precedent, is not a particularly exceptional case or a surprising outcome. The facts of the case were as follows. CompuCredit marketed an Aspire credit card to individuals with weak credit histories with the marketed purpose of helping them improve their credit rating. Consumers, who were the credit card holders of the Aspire credit card, filed a class action in federal court against CompuCredit and other defendants, asserting that those defendants had violated the Credit Repair Organizations Act by making representations in the sales process and by imposing excessive fees on the card. It turns out that the credit card agreement or the application included an arbitration clause, and so the defendants sought to compel arbitration of the case and filed a motion to compel arbitration in federal district court in California where the case was pending. The district court held that the arbitration clause was unenforceable under the Credit Repair Organizations Act, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed with Judge Tashima dissenting. The essential argument that the Ninth Circuit made, which is reflected in the dissenting opinion of the Supreme Court, is as follows, that there's three characteristics of the Credit Repair Organizations Act that, in the Ninth Circuit's view, resulted in it precluding arbitration of claims. The first was a pretty standard provision setting up or authorizing a cause of action for violations of the Act, and there was language actually in that provision providing that the court may allow, the court being the relevant language, may allow recovery of punitive damages. Second provision was a disclosure obligation that the Act imposed on credit repair organizations. The text of the disclosure that had to be made was specified in the Act, and there was language saying precisely that to the consumers, you have a right to sue a credit repair organization that violates the Act. And the Ninth Circuit construed this right to sue language as meaning not a right to go to arbitration, but a right to go to court because you sue in court. And then finally, the Act had a non-waiver provision providing that any waiver by a consumer of any protection provided under this Act shall be treated as void. And so the argument that the Ninth Circuit made in its opinion in Greenwood was that consumers had a right to go to court as shown by the disclosure language and the cause of action provision. And under this non-waiver provision, that right to go to court was non-waivable, and any attempt to do so, such as through an arbitration clause, would be void. Now, in its opinion, the Ninth Circuit actually acknowledged that its decision created a split with decisions of the Third and the Eleventh Circuits, which had held that claims under the Act were arbitrable. Given that split, the Supreme Court not surprisingly granted cert in the case, and then, as already noted, reversed 8-1. Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion, Justice Sotomayor and Kagan concurred in the judgment, and Justice Ginsburg was the lone dissenter. Now, the mere fact that this was an 8-1 case, as I said before, suggested that it was a much less difficult case than either Renacena or Concepcion, which have both been very controversial, not only in the public policy arena, but also in the arbitration law arena. And to understand why this is a less difficult case, I think it's helpful to review some of the history of how the Supreme Court has dealt with non-arbitrability issues. Just to be clear, the issue here differs from the issue in Concepcion, for example, in that the issue in Concepcion was a preemption issue. In Concepcion, the Supreme Court held that California law making class arbitration waivers unconscionable in arbitration clauses was preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act. And under the Supremacy Clause, the federal law is going to be supreme to conflicting state laws. Here we're talking about two potentially conflicting federal statutes, so the issue isn't one of federal supremacy, it's one of construing these two potentially conflicting federal laws. Prior to, say, the mid-1970s, courts, including the Supreme Court, consistently held that federal statutory claims could not be arbitrated, that they were non-arbitrable. And the leading Supreme Court case was Wilco versus Swan, which held that claims under the 1933 Securities Act could not be arbitrated. Beginning in the mid-1970s, however, the Supreme Court began chipping away at Wilco. Initially, the court distinguished Wilco in cases such as Mitsubishi by limiting Wilco to domestic claims and permitting arbitration of claims arising out of international transactions. But eventually, it got to the point where there was really nothing left of Wilco, and the court overruled it in 1987 in the Rodriguez de Quillas case. So since that time, really since the mid-1970s, there's this consistent line of U.S. Supreme Court cases holding that federal statutory claims can be arbitrated. So 1933 Securities Act claim, 1934 Securities Exchange Act, Sherman Act, RICO, Age Discrimination and Employment Act, court consistently held that claims arising under these federal statutes could be arbitrated. And even though, for example, in the 1933 Securities Act, there is a non-waiver provision. The language is a little different from the one that is in the Credit Repair Organizations Act, but it does limit the ability to waive provisions under the Act. Under other federal statutes, the court held that claims could be arbitrated, even though, for example, the statute provided for federal courts to have exclusive jurisdiction. In other words, state courts did not have jurisdiction over the case. Only a federal court did. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court held that claims arising under those statutes could be arbitrated. So again, a consistent line of cases since the mid-1970s permitting arbitration of claims arising under federal statutes. It was such that by 2005, Alan Rao, a leading arbitration scholar from the University of Texas, described the category of non-arbitral claims in the United States as a null set, meaning there were none. So given that history, it's not surprising that the Credit Repair Organizations Act claims could be arbitrated and that the Supreme Court would so hold. Second development since, again, early 2000s, Congress has actually begun including some provisions in federal statutes that either make arbitration agreements unenforceable or that expressly preclude arbitration of federal statutory claims. So for motor vehicle franchise contracts, contracts between car dealers and car manufacturers, Congress has provided that pre-dispute arbitration agreements are unenforceceable. Most recently in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress expressly provided that certain whistleblower claims under the Act were not subject to arbitration. And so what you have is a consistent line of cases where statutes were silent on arbitration, the Supreme Court holding that claims arising under the statutes could be arbitrated, and then more recent statutes where Congress expressly addresses arbitration, providing that the claims could not be arbitrated, which was clearly not the Credit Repair Organizations Act. So given that background, how did the majority analyze the claim in Greenwood? It acknowledged that there was a statutory cause of action under the Act, but correctly, I think, made clear that nothing in that cause of action provision gives consumers the right to bring the claim in court. The source for the right to sue language was a separate disclosure provision that essentially, again, set out what credit repair organizations were supposed to tell consumers. And the court majority's interpretation of that provision was that it was a colloquial method of communicating to consumers, that's a quote from the opinion, that they had a legal right to bring a cause of action. But it did not itself establish that right or that cause of action and did not itself give a substantive right or even a procedural right to come to court. It was just a description, colloquial language, not particularly accurate or not necessarily precisely accurate, that was not sufficient to override the provision of the Federal Arbitration Act making arbitration agreements enforceable. The majority also referenced the more recent statutes making arbitration agreements unenforceable and federal statutory claims not subject to arbitration to illustrate that when Congress, in fact, wants to restrict the ability to arbitrate under a federal statute, it knows how to do it. And that in those cases, there was express language, no such language under the Credit Repair Organizations Act. And so for both of those reasons, the majority held that these claims were subject to arbitration and reversed the Ninth Circuit. As I noted before, Justice Sotomayor concurred. She agreed with the result that the majority reached. And again, to be clear, the concurrence, joined by Justice Kagan, was in the judgment, not in the majority's opinion. So she agreed with the result, but she thought it was a closer case than the majority seemed to think it was. And the reason she wrote separately was to emphasize that express language in a statute precluding arbitration of claims was not necessarily a requirement before a court would find that the statute made the claims non-arbitrable. Or stated otherwise, there's actually, in the long line of Supreme Court cases dealing with arbitrability issues, common language used setting out a test for when claims are non-arbitrable. And that language, this is a quote from the Gilmer case, emphasized that the burden was on the party challenging the availability of arbitration. But Gilmer Court stated that if such an intention exists, it will be discoverable in the text of the relevant statute, its legislative history, or in an inherent conflict between arbitration and the statute's underlying purposes. In other words, that the court could find a claim non-arbitrable based not only on the statutory text, but also on legislative history or a conflict with the purposes of the statute. The majority opinion in Greenwood, written by Justice Scalia, focused solely on text. And given Justice Scalia's skepticism of legislative history, that's not particularly surprising. The concurring opinion, to emphasize the language from prior cases that suggested that you didn't necessarily need express language, but that legislative history or, again, a conflict with the purpose of the statute would be sufficient. I will note that the court has never held a claim non-arbitral based solely on legislative history or conflict with purposes of the statute, but there is at least language in prior opinions, repeated in a number of prior opinions, suggesting that those are possible bases for finding a claim non-arbitrable. And the key reason for Justice Sotomayor's concurrence was to make clear that that was still a possibility. The dissenting opinion by Justice Ginsburg relied heavily on the right to sue language and took a different view of the relevance of that language from the majority, not based on what the drafters intended by putting that language in the disclosure statement, but on how the language would be understood by consumers. So her view was that the right to sue language in the disclosure would be understood by consumers as giving them a right to sue, and the statute should be construed accordingly. She also, in her dissenting opinion, noted that the non-waiver language in the Credit Repair Organizations Act was different from and potentially broader than the non-waiver language in prior statutes, and accordingly did provide a basis for construing the Credit Repair Organizations Act as precluding arbitration of claims under the Act. So why does this decision matter? As I said before, it is not a surprising decision. It's not an earth-shattering decision. It doesn't particularly break new ground in any way in determining when a claim under a federal statute is or is not subject to arbitration. I mean, very much the opposite. It follows in a long line of cases and is consistent with all those cases in holding that the federal statutory claims can be arbitrated. So no surprises as far as the outcome in the case, and again, that's consistent with eight of the justices agreeing with the holding, although not necessarily agreeing on the rationale. A couple points of note where the decision may be at least potentially important. The first is, again, with the majority's analysis focusing solely on the text. Justice Sotomayor, in her concurrence, as I said, noted that reliance on text, and stated that it should not be read as meaning text is the only way you can find a claim non-arbitrable. If in fact it is, that's at least a change in the test from the dicta in the prior cases. Although, again, as I noted, prior cases haven't held claims not arbitrable based on legislative history or purpose, so it may not be as much of a change as it sounds, but certainly the mode of analysis of the majority opinion differs from prior cases, although the outcome doesn't. A second reason why Greenwood may be important is that it may foreshadow the next case to come before the Supreme Court raising non-arbitrability issues, that is, whether claims under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act can be arbitrated. The Ninth Circuit actually recently addressed that issue as well in a case called Kolev versus Euro Motors West, opinion by Judge Reinhardt, dissent by Judge Smith. The court in Kolev held that Magnuson-Moss Warranty claims could not be arbitrated. The court acknowledged that it created a split with other circuits, and in fact, state Supreme Courts, the majority of which have held that Magnuson-Moss claims can be arbitrated. And the similarities to Greenwood are actually quite striking. There's a federal statute. It is construed by the Ninth Circuit as not permitting arbitration of the claims. That decision creates a split with other circuits. And there's a strong dissent arguing that claims under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act here should be arbitrated, just like in Greenwood. Similarly, a strong dissent arguing in favor of arbitration. The case currently has pending a motion for rehearing en banc before the Ninth Circuit, but if that motion is denied or if en banc review the Ninth Circuit reaches the same result, Kolev is a prime candidate for Supreme Court review, given the split among the circuits, and frankly, given that this issue has been litigated much more than the issue in the Greenwood case, it's one where the Supreme Court usefully could weigh in and resolve the conflict. I will note that the argument against arbitration of Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act claims is a stronger one than the argument in Greenwood, and frankly is as strong as any I have seen, other than cases where the statute itself specifically makes arbitration unavailable, for two reasons. One is the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act actually does address arbitration in its provisions, although what it addresses is non-binding arbitration, not binding arbitration. So the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act requires businesses that want to establish a non-binding arbitration process to so specify in their contract. Now, that provision doesn't, again, specifically address binding arbitration clauses, but at least could be read as impliedly excluding the availability of binding arbitration because it addresses non-binding arbitration. In addition, there are issues of agency deference in the Magnuson-Moss context that have not been present in other of these non-arbitrability cases. In its opinion, the Ninth Circuit relied on an FTC interpretation of Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act as not permitting binding arbitration clauses. And under Chevron, at least many agency interpretations of statutes, they're in a position, or they are agency interpretations of statutes that they administer, are subject to deference by the courts. So for both of these reasons, the non-arbitrability argument in the Magnuson-Moss context is a much stronger one and probably explains why courts have been much more divergent in their views of that issue. And again, if the Ninth Circuit does not consider Kolev en banc or again reaffirms its decision in Kolev, it seems a prime candidate for review by the Supreme Court. And again, the court usefully could address the Magnuson-Moss issue, which has caused a lot of differing views among the lower courts. So again, bottom line, in Greenwood, the Supreme Court held that claims under the Credit Repair Organizations Act could be arbitrated. Nothing surprising about that outcome, a fairly straightforward application of prior precedent, and gets an outcome that is consistent with what the majority of courts had already done. But the opinion does raise some interesting issues that may have some impact in future cases that may soon come before the court.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.